Buenas tardes. El profesor Walter Gilbert, o sea, Wally Gilbert, es como lo dice todo el mundo, ha sido un hombre que ha aparecido mucho en la prensa en estos últimos años, porque reúne una combinación que es extraordinariamente infrecuente. Ha sido un hombre de una carrera científica espectacular, seguida por una carrera de hombre de negocios, por lo menos meteórica, digamos. Todo ese tipo de combinación es muy rara. Y es un hombre, además, que tiene una cierta facilidad para hacer llevar, por lo menos, al mundo del interés general, las cosas que pasan en los laboratorios, sus posibles aplicaciones. Para poder entender un poco este hombre, voy a tratar de contarle a ustedes muy brevemente de dónde sale la personalidad curiosísima de Wally Gilbert, coronada finalmente por un premio Nobel y toda una retahíla de premios de menor cuantía de la pedrea académica habitual. El apellido Gilbert suena a apellido ilustre inglés o francés, y había hecho un científico inglés del siglo XVI que escribió sobre el magnetismo, pero no es él. Resulta que el Gilbert, como típico de Estados Unidos, es un cambio de apellido hecho por unos emigrantes de la Europa Oriental llegados a Estados Unidos que convirtieron su apellido yiddish en un apellido que sonara inglés. Esos emigrantes eran gente sin duda de una tradición intelectual. El padre de Wally Gilbert fue catedrático de la Universidad de Harvard, y eso en aquella época, donde Harvard era difícil llegar allá si no se era protestante y anglosajón como Dios manda, pues era todo un éxito. Y la madre de Wally Gilbert se educó en una comuna anarquista, en la cual tenían particular dedicación a la educación de la infancia. De manera que las dos cosas reúnen dos cosas muy típicas de Estados Unidos. Por una parte, el ambiente este académico que hay, por ejemplo, en alrededor de Harvard. Y por otra parte, el experimentalismo social típico de Estados Unidos a los primeros de siglo, que ha desaparecido completamente, sumergido bajo un aluvión de hamburgueserías y de cohetes MX, pero que ya ha desaparecido, de acuerdo. Pero está ahí todavía representado un poco en Wally Gilbert. Wally Gilbert empezó a estudiar, como su carrera intelectual empezó flojo. Me da la sensación de que fue un mal estudiante. El director de su instituto de bachillerato le tuvo que mandar una carta recordándole de que aquello no era un centro de enseñanza por correspondencia. Y es que el tiempo que no estaba en el instituto, el hombre estaba haciendo su experimento en su casa. Por ejemplo, su primer experimento publicado, pero no por los resultados científicos, fue el que a los 12 años estaba echándole ácido sulfúrico a un poco de zinc para fabricar hidrógeno, y la cosa estalló y el hombre acabó en el hospital. Después de ver las estrellas de esa manera, se dedicó a ver las estrellas de otra, haciendo telescopios y puliéndose él mismo las lentes, todavía cuando estaba en el bachillerato. La siguiente manía era la de irse a las bibliotecas y empollar sobre física absolutamente todo lo que salía. Naturalmente sacaba malas notas, no es extraño que el mundo de la academia es distinto. Entonces el hombre se pasó hasta trabajar en Harvard, a estudiar naturalmente física y química, e hizo la carrera habitual de hacer el bachelor, hacer el máster, y de ahí se pasó de Cambridge, Estados Unidos, pasó a Cambridge de Inglaterra para hacer el doctorado en la Universidad de Cambridge en matemática, esencialmente matemática aplicada, bajo la dirección de un hombre que después sería también premio Nobel, Abdus-Salam. Volvió a Estados Unidos, la misma Universidad de Harvard. El hombre no ha salido prácticamente de Cambridge. Cambridge de un lado o del otro del Atlántico, pero siempre en Cambridge. Y en Estados Unidos ha hecho una carrera sumamente sorprendente, porque es de las pocas gentes que en Harvard ha hecho la carrera desde becario hasta catedrático ininterrumpidamente. Lo normal es que en Harvard, al final de assistant professor, los echen a la calle sin ninguna piedad. Y es de los hombres que han seguido allí. Pero su carrera no ha sido en el mismo sitio ni en la misma dirección. Primero empezó en física y al cabo de un poco tiempo, el año 1960, se pasó a la biología. Aquí empieza entonces esa extraña carrera de gente que hace física y se pasa a la biología. Entre esa carrera, el atractivo en este caso viene determinado por una amistad concebida durante un guateque en la Universidad de Cambridge de Inglaterra, algunos años antes, con Jim Watson, que lo conoció allí. Esa amistad siguió cuando los dos estaban en Harvard. La mujer de Wally Gilbert, que por cierto es poetisa y buena y publicada, que ya quisieran muchas poetisas, pues trabajó de ayudante de laboratorio de Watson, de manera que se conocían, hablaban con frecuencia, y en el verano de 1960, pues, finalmente Jim Watson le convenció de que en su laboratorio estaban pasando unas cosas interesantísimas y que se estaba perdiendo lo más interesante que había por allá. Le convenció de que fuera por allí a hacer algún experimentito y mirar un poco, y lo que pasó es que Wally Gilbert no ha dejado desde entonces la biología. Siempre ha hecho lo mismo que con el ácido sulfúrico, aquí pasa lo mismo. Siempre se lanza, de hecho, a hacer el experimento antes de empezar en nada. Era muy fácil, porque es que resulta que la literatura total que había entonces sobre el tema que abordó consistía de 6 artículos científicos, y el tema era el ARN mensajero. Le dedicó el RM mensajero a funcionamiento del RM mensajero, pero voy a cortar porque eso no acabó nunca, 3 o 4 años de su vida, y luego se pasó a un tema que concibió como más interesante, que es el aislamiento del represor, la regulación de la información genética. El procedimiento que siguió para aislar el represor, que quizá el trabajo más famoso de la época clásica suyo, el procedimiento que siguió, de hecho, ya se había aplicado. El procedimiento era buscar en Escherichia coli, la bacteria Escherichia coli, alguna proteína que se uniera específicamente a isopropil tiogalactósido radioactivo. Esa proteína tenía que ser, por indicaciones que ya había, podía tener una de las propiedades del represor. El procedimiento ya se había usado y no había salido el represor, había salido otra cosa, había salido la permeasa de los beta-lactósidos. El truco consistió entonces en usar mutantes de Escherichia coli, en los cuales la afinidad es mayor y el número, en fin, lo habitual. De nuevo, un ejemplo interesante de cómo se hace la biología contemporánea, a base de una mezcla de actividades, de trabajos bioquímicos combinados con un análisis genético profundo que permite hacer determinados experimentos que serían imposibles sin ellos. El trabajo sobre el aislamiento del represor llevó relativamente poco. Lo hizo con un alemán, Benno Müller-Hill, que ahora está en Alemania, que era postdoc, y estuvo completo hacia finales del año 1966. Fue la primera vez que se aislaba un represor en dura competencia con un vecino de la vuelta a la esquina, Max Taschne, que estaba aislando otro represor por otro procedimiento totalmente distinto. A partir de ahí, la carrera se estanca para el punto de vista de que el hombre se pasó nada menos que 11 años de su vida investigando de manera fina la interacción entre el represor y el operador, entre el represor y el fragmento de ADN que se une. Y esos trabajos que tienen un enorme interés, que han hecho historia naturalmente en el mundo de la biología molecular, le llevaron de manera muy sorprendente al siguiente gran descubrimiento, que es el de la secuenciación de la estructura de la secuenciación del ADN. El hombre no quería descubrir la secuenciación del ADN, no estaba en eso. El hombre estaba averiguando qué parte de la secuencia del operador, el operador un fragmento de ADN, se une al represor, se une a la proteína que tiene que regularlo. Y apareció por allí un ruso, un tipo que se llama Andrei Mirzabiekov, y el ruso tenía una buena idea que decirle, se vino a su laboratorio a contárselo. Tenía un procedimiento de tratamiento químico del ADN, por lo cual permitiría reconocer aquellas bases que se hubieran quedado sin tapar por la proteína, cuando la proteína se uniera al ADN. Ese procedimiento químico se lo recomendó muy vivamente Mirzabiekov a Gilbert y bueno, pues ahí dijo, sí, lo vamos a hacer, muy interesante. Al cabo de 3 o 4 años, el ruso apareció, al cabo de 3 o 4 meses, el ruso apareció otra vez por el laboratorio. Pero ¿cómo? ¿No han hecho ustedes todavía el experimento? Hacerlo inmediatamente. El experimento se hizo y se publicó, está hecho el experimento hecho por él y su colaborador de entonces, Alan Maxam, y el propio Mirzabiekov. Pero durante el tiempo que estuvieron haciendo ese experimento cayeron en la cuenta de que lo mismo que se podía usar para averiguar qué bases de una secuencia más o menos conocida, de hecho se creía que se conocía pero no estaba bien, son las que están tapadas por el represor, también se podía usar la misma técnica de otra manera para mirar la secuencia de ADN desconocida. Y entonces fue cuando comenzó el trabajo hecho por Alan Maxam y Wally Gilbert, buscando las condiciones de reactivo apropiadas y otros reactivos distintos de los sugeridos por Mirzabiekov y la forma de hacerlo, y consagrado finalmente en un trabajo del año 1977 en el que se propone la lectura de la secuencia del ADN. El trabajo es sensacional en la historia de la biología porque nos sacó del analfabetismo a los biólogos. Parece mentira que hasta hace solamente 8 años el texto genético era prácticamente ilegible. Desde entonces se han puesto a leer texto genético tan deprisa que ya se saben unos 5 millones de pares de bases. Y entonces surge el problema mismo que cuando se tiene una gran cantidad de textos, bibliotecas, lo que sea. Tiene que haber alguien que lo explique, qué demonios dice allí. Lo que va a hacer hoy en su charla Wally Gilbert es contarle a ustedes parte de la interpretación de lo que ha salido. Ahora, precisamente, prácticamente por el año 77, cuando el hombre estaba consiguiendo finalizar la secuenciación del ADN, le convencieron unos conocidos suyos, uno de Boston y otro de Toronto, que eran empresarios, de que se lanzara al mundo de la empresa. Lanzara una empresa donde el principal capital iba a ser él mismo, Wally Gilbert. Y al principio no fue nada fácil de convencer, la cosa parece que ha llevado bastante tiempo. Pero al cabo de más o menos de un año, el año 78, en una reunión que hubo en Suiza, finalmente una pandilla de científicos, entre los cuales está él, pero están también Charlie Weissman, de suizo, y Hofschneider, de Múnich, y Murray, de Edimburgo, y Sharp de Boston, y alguna gente así, estaban en una reunión con una serie de capitalistas americanos, canadienses, suizos, y llegaron finalmente al acuerdo de constitución de la empresa llamada Biogen. Biogen no es la primera empresa de biotecnología, ni mucho menos. La primera, de hecho, hace ya más de 15 años antes de eso, que se había fundado en los años 60. Sin embargo, quizás ha sido la que más ha salido, los más de 200 que hay, la que más ha salido en los periódicos. Y la razón es quizás sea un poco, ha sido un cierto deseo de espectacularidad por parte de la empresa. El año 80, por ejemplo, la empresa llamó a la prensa para decirles que habían descubierto cómo clonar el interferón. un trabajo que había hecho Charlie Bachman. Muchos científicos se cabrearon horrendamente porque dijeron que estaba feo eso de llamar a la prensa sin primero ver los resultados, discutirlos, publicarlos en la forma seria científica habitual. Desde entonces, Biogen ha estado con frecuencia en la prensa. Ha estado con frecuencia en la prensa y su director ejecutivo, director con mando en todos los trabajos, tanto científicos como económicos, o sea, Wally Gilbert, el dictador absoluto de la empresa, estuvo al mismo tiempo, de mucho tiempo, en la prensa por esas mismas razones. El tratamiento que le han dado ha sido de lo más destacado, por lo menos en Estados Unidos. Sin embargo, la enorme sorpresa fue que hace un par de meses, una reunión de los empresarios y Wally Gilbert dimitió de sus cargos en la empresa como director ejecutivo y se quedó como miembro solamente del comité científico y del comité de gestión, pero no como director ejecutivo del tinglado. Aquello fue visto de una manera un poco como chocante y sorprendente de todo el mundo. Por una parte, fíjense ustedes que es como el descubrimiento de América, pero al revés. O sea, Colón convenció a los pinzones para que fueran, ¿no? Y luego, cuando Colón se quería volver, los pinzones lo obligaron a seguir. Pero aquí fue al revés. Los pinzones convencieron a Colón, quiero decir, a Wally Gilbert, para que hiciera la empresa. Y luego, cuando Gilbert decía que está a la vuelta de la esquina, que los grandes éxitos están ahí, que esto está enseguida, entonces los que se rajaron fueron los pinzones y le dijeron que no, que va, que esto no fuera. Entonces, la situación que ha llevado esto, que la empresa es una empresa muy grande, una empresa de 400 empleados, con sedes en Suecia, en Suiza y en Estados Unidos, y con un capital invertido de cerca de 200 millones de dólares, es una empresa enormemente grande para comparación con la empresa de biotecnología. Pero una empresa que no vende nada y que, como consecuencia, pues, pierde dinero. El año pasado perdió del orden de 15 millones de dólares en el año pasado solo. De manera que sus compañeros de empresa empezaron a sentirse muy nerviosos. Wally Gilbert es un gran visionario, es un hombre que ve el Monte Everest, la cumbre que se ve allí lejana, diciendo, ahí está, a la vuelta de la esquina, no más que seguir andando. Y los otros no ven la cumbre, no ven más que los barrancos que hay en medio, diciendo, ¿qué va? Con esos barrancos no hay forma de llegar allá. En esa controversia ha sido donde al final Wally Gilbert ha salido de la empresa y su situación actual es la de desempleado. Bueno, no exactamente desempleado. Tiene un empleo no remunerado como ayudante de un doctorando en el laboratorio de Jeremy Knowles en la Universidad de Harvard. Porque el hombre, los experimentos que está haciendo el doctorando, pues le interesaban mucho a Gilbert. Y entonces le estaba dando continuamente la tabarra a su jefe, a Knowles, diciéndole, oye, ¿qué pasa de esos experimentos? Y siempre decía, pues mira, ya sabe, el doctorando, pues no le sale, no ha hecho, ha tenido que hacer otra cosa. Lo que pasa con los doctorandos, van despacito. Entonces el hombre perdía la paciencia. Entonces Knowles le dice, oye, tú ni hablar. Si tienes tanta ganas de protestar, ¿por qué no vienes a hacer los experimentos? Al fin y al cabo estás en el paro. Y le cogió la palabra. El problema fue convencer al doctorando cuando le dijeron, oye, un premio Nobel de ayudante de laboratorio. Dijo, ni hablar. Ni hablar. Entonces, el doctorando, Jeremy Knowles me contó que para convencer al doctorando recurrieron a los nietos del doctorando. Dicen, que no los tiene todavía, claro está. Fíjate tú lo que le vas a contar a tus nietos. Rarísimo es el doctorando que tiene un ayudante de laboratorio, pero el que tiene uno que sea premio Nobel es desconocido. Al cabo de un tiempo el doctorando se aficionó y le dijo que de acuerdo, que podía venir. Bueno, pues no habían pasado más de dos o tres días y me contaba Jeremy Knowles su absoluta horripilante experiencia. Llega por el laboratorio y se encuentra al doctorando y a Gilbert sentados en la misma mesa, que comparten la misma mesa de trabajo, y el doctorando le estaba echando un rapapolvos terrible a Gilbert, diciéndole, pero esos experimentos no tienen los controles bien hechos, gritaba el doctorando. Es decir, el primer día le tienes respeto, los dos días le pierdes respeto hasta el premio Nobel si lo tienes de ayudante. Bueno, ¿y qué va a pasar de Gilbert en el inmediato futuro? Va a seguir en Harvard, va a volver a crear su laboratorio, va a dedicarse de nuevo 100% del tiempo a la ciencia, con su rasgo habitual, que es una mezcla de una tozudez absoluta, representada quizá por la imagen que me transmitió uno de sus amigos. Dice, se van los de Biogen, se van uno de esos son empresarios importantes, se van a una isla del Caribe a discutir futuro de la empresa y esa cosa. Y entonces, pues todo el mundo se lo pasa a pipa, y menos Wally Gilbert, porque decide que quiere aprender windsurfing, como se diga eso en español. Y entonces le dicen, el monitor le dice que ni hablar, que es el tío no lo deja echar al agua, que primero tiene que subirse en un palo que le ponen encima de un bloque de cemento. Y ahí subido en la pala, encima del bloque de cemento, ahí tiene que hacer ejercicio hasta que vea que aquello está en condiciones. Entonces el Wally se pasa todo el tiempo, la semana, los que estuvieron allí, absolutamente todo rato libre subido en su bloque de cemento y su palo. Y todo el mundo diciendo, pero estás loco con lo que están pasando los demás. El último día, a las 7 de la mañana, poco antes ya de que tenían que salir de aquel lugar, el monitor finalmente le autorizó a echarse al agua. Quiere decir, no, totalmente inasequible al desaliento. Para terminar, les contaré a ustedes que Wally representa, además, para ustedes una experiencia que es una América difícil de ver, quizá aquí. Para españoles que estamos más bien expuestos a ver, pues no sé, digamos, huéspedes de Torrejón, ¿no? Y, no sé, actores de cine que hablan también en este lugar dentro de poco, pues Wally Gilbert representa una América muy distinta. Es una América que quizás sea lo más interesante que tenga para muchos de ustedes que tal vez tengan interés en dedicarse a la ciencia. Esa América es lo más interesante que hay en América. Y esa América está representada quizá de manera más espectacular, en primer lugar quizá por la ciudad de Cambridge, en segundo lugar dentro de ella por la Universidad de Harvard, y quizá dentro de la Universidad de Harvard, muy destacado ejemplo, como Wally Gilbert. Muchas gracias.
Okay, thank you. That was a lovely description. And I'm afraid Enrique is a very hard act to follow. What I'd like to talk to you about is a series of recent ideas about how the structure of genes that we perceive now, when we can go down and examine those genes with DNA sequencing, how the structure of genes gives us some insight into the overall course of evolution and some picture of how that course has been over several billion years of history. In the middle 70s, we knew that the genes in bacteria were continuous sequences along DNA. That you would start at one point, run along a DNA molecule, stop at the end of a gene, and in between, all of the DNA sequence coded for protein. When the first genes from mammals were sequenced around 1977, it became obvious that they had a different structure. They had a structure in which the sequences that coded for parts of the protein were separated one from another by long stretches of DNA that lay between those sequences. And that's shown on the first slide. We call, right here across the top of the slide, is an indication of a DNA sequence. And we call these parts, which code finally for parts of the protein, exons. And we call this part of the DNA introns, and that's the part that does not finally code for the protein. Because as was discovered by Phil Sharp and others in 1977, when you copy this whole region into an RNA molecule and make a long transcript, you then splice out of that RNA molecule the sequences that correspond to this intron and the sequences that correspond to this intron, by almost bringing the ends together like this, cutting out this part of the molecule and tying this piece to that and this piece to that to produce the final RNA molecule, the final message, which corresponds only to the exons on the DNA. This process takes place in the nucleus, and the result is that this RNA molecule goes to the cytoplasm of the cell and is translated into protein. And the protein then corresponds just to this region and this, and does not correspond to any of this DNA sequence in the middle. Today we know a good deal about the biochemistry of this process. We know that there are special sequences on the DNA right here that would be at this point, and right here that would be at this point of the intron. And those special sequences serve as commands to splice out this whole loop of DNA. But the problem that I'd like to talk to you about today is, why is this extra DNA there in the gene? Why does a gene have a structure like this? Next slide. The facts that we know about introns and exons today are almost summarized here. The major fact is that the introns are very much longer than the exons. The exons, the regions that code for protein, range in size from something like 20 to 300 bases. In fact, this distribution is peaked around 120 to 150 bases. It's peaked around 40 to 50 amino acids, with very few longer stretches. Although genes themselves, on the average, are something like code for something like 300 amino acids, and very large genes code for 1,000 to several thousand amino acids. The introns are very heterogeneous in size, and in fact are much larger than the exons, and extend out to 10,000 or 20,000 bases. So in fact, as you look along the DNA in a gene, you can find 150 bases that codes for a piece of protein, and then there'll be 1,000 to 2,000 to 5,000 bases that do not code for anything, and then another little stretch of another 100 bases that codes for more of the protein, and then another stretch of several thousand bases that doesn't code for anything. And the consequence of this is that the genes are very much larger than we thought they would be. In 1977, we thought the genes would be exactly the size needed to code for proteins, and therefore something like 1,000 bases long. Today, we know the genes are anywhere from 10 to 30 times larger than they need to be if they just coded for proteins. And it's common to find genes that are 50,000 bases long. And the very longest genes that are known, which is a gene for human factor 8 that's been worked out by Genentech and Genetics Institute, that gene is 200,000 bases long. So the problem before us is really to try to explain why is this the case. We can. And what I'm going to argue for you is to suggest that the introns play a role that's determined solely by their size, not by their sequence. We can tell, in fact, that there is probably no role that the introns play determined by their sequence, because if we compare the sequence of the same gene in two different organisms, like a mouse and a human being and a chicken, then we, in those different organisms, the parts of the gene that code for protein, the exons, are very similar. But the introns have changed a very great deal. Those DNA sequences drift over evolution as rapidly as they can, as rapidly as any sequences drift and change. So that there is no, we can't find any strongly conserved sequence in introns to serve as an explanation for what they are doing. And the explanation that I will suggest to you and argue for in the course of this talk is that the primary role of the introns is a role that they have solely because of their size on DNA. And the one property that a DNA molecule has, solely as a function of its length, is the property of recombination, the ability of two DNA molecules to break and join to create another, a new DNA molecule. Next slide. We thought we knew, and in the case of bacteria, we do know, how a DNA molecule can be reshaped to make a protein that is of, let us say, double length. We have a protein that codes for some protein subunit, and we want to make a protein of twice the length. Then in our thinking, classical thinking, we thought we knew how this process happened. We take one copy of a gene that would code just for this part of the protein. We bring up a second copy of that gene, and we combine the two by a process that's called illegitimate recombination, breaking the DNA here and joining it to the DNA there, by some act that doesn't require that the sequence here matches the sequence there. We break and join the DNA to make a double-length gene. That gene then can make a double-length product, of RNA product, and that obviously can make a double-length protein product. This recombination act is very rare because the sequences don't match, and it has to occur in phase so that we can read the protein sequence across here and connect it up with the protein sequence across there. Next slide. That process looks very different if we do that in an organism that can splice its DNA. Because then one gene product here, in order to make a double-length protein, we can bring up one copy of the gene, bring up a second copy of the gene on another copy of that chromosome. But now that same act of recombination that's going to combine these two DNA molecules can occur anywhere within 10,000 bases of the end of this gene, and anywhere within 10,000 bases in front of this one. And that process is then essentially 10 million times faster than the process that I showed you on the last slide. And rather than making a product in which this point is exactly attached to that, it makes a product in which there is a long intron in between. If there are splicing signals here and there, then as soon as we make a long transcript of this region, we can splice from this point to that, make this double-length message, make the double-length protein. If there aren't splicing signals here and there, then we can imagine that at a very low frequency, we occasionally splice from here to there among all other possible splices we could make, and that connects this point with that and makes a double-length protein. And if you think about that process, you'll realize that that process is a much more effective way for evolution to happen than the process shown on the slide before. Because this process involves a very frequent process, this recombination act, that at a low frequency then produces a small amount of the new product. Whereas the process that I showed you on the earlier slide is a very rare process that produces a large amount of this product. The very rare process is then very hard to arrive at for it to occur naturally. The very frequent process can occur in many members of the species. And the small amount of product is still enough for natural selection to work on. That small amount of the new product can still give the organism an advantage, and therefore natural selection can then over time improve the splicing pattern by improving the sequence here and there, so the splicing then occurs readily. So this picture of combining exons by recombination within the introns is a much natural way, more natural way for evolution to put together the pieces of a protein. This interpretation says that the introns are there because they were used by recombination to put the exons together. And they're large solely because it's easier, historically, if we look back into the history of some gene, it's easier to find, we're more likely to find, an act that has put that gene together with a large intron than an act that has put the gene together with a small intron. This would say we would expect the intron sizes to change change by mutation, and we see that in the world. And this interpretation would say that if we have a defined unit of a protein, we will find in a protein with multiple domains that unit put together as a series of exons separated by introns. And over the recent years, since this idea was suggested in 1977, over recent years, more and more gene examples have shown us that the genes of the vertebrates do look like exons put together by recombination. Next slide, please. Here we're looking at a set of genes for the immunoglobulins and for a whole set of proteins that are related to them. And that entire set of proteins has a common structure. It's got a common subunit, about 110 amino acids long, that folds up in space And so it forms the core of an immunoglobulin. It's called the immunoglobulin fold. And one copy of that occurs in the protein called beta 2 microglobulin. And there it occurs on a single exon. Two copies of that unit occur in the light chain of the immunoglobulins. And that same exon is then clearly repeated on the DNA. Four copies occur in the heavy chain of the immunoglobulin. And there are four copies of that same exon repeated with introns between them along the DNA. Two copies occur in the receptor on T cells. Two copies occur in the histocompatibility antigens. And this entire family of genes, family of proteins, when you look at the gene structure, there's a clear use of the introns to put together copies of this basic domain. There are two other aspects of this idea that show up in this family. In the beginning of all of these proteins, there is a leader sequence. It's called the hydrophobic leader sequence, and it's used to take the protein out of the cell. In each case, it is on a separate exon, as though it has been added by this sort of recombination act I've suggested to the basic immunoglobulin shape. In the heavy chains, halfway down the chains, there is a special region called a hinge. And that lies on a separate exon, as though it again was added by recombination as this whole chain was being assembled. And at the very end of these chains, they're very often domains that extend into the cytoplasm of the cells. And they also lie on separate exons. Next slide. This is another example of a protein that is clearly made up of a single exon repeated over and over again along the DNA. It's the gene for a protein called collagen, which is a very long string of amino acids, about 1,000 long, that forms a helical structure. Three such strings wind around each other and forms the basic substance that makes up cartilage. The gene itself, stretching almost over some, this is not quite complete, almost over some 50 kilobases, 50,000 bases of DNA, is made up of a number of very small coding regions, most of which code for 18 amino acids, which is just one half turn along the collagen structure. And there are some 40 copies of that exon along the gene, some very close together, some very far apart. That gene structure is entirely inexplicable, except by the sort of theory I've been suggesting, in which we look upon it as a basic little unit of protein structure that then has been repeated time and time again by recombination that's created these introns. So these examples and others show that if we look at genes for the proteins that make up the very differentiated proteins in the vertebrates, we find those proteins, wherever the protein has a repeated structure, we find that repeated structure is clearly shown as exons tied together in a repeated structure by the introns. And from that, we can conclude it's most likely that all of those genes with repeated structures were put together by recombination in the introns in the way I've just suggested. The particular underlying picture that I'm suggesting is that each exon, in some sense, codes for a unit of protein structure, a domain in space, a functional piece that you add to make another, to give a new function to some other piece of the protein. And one of the challenges against this idea for several years has been the sort of challenge that if this were true, we would expect to find the same exon in many different proteins. Very recently, an example of that has just been worked out by Brown and Goldstein in Texas, who have examined the structure of the LDL receptor, the light density lipoprotein particle receptor, and found that in that gene there is a repeated domain that also appears in certain other genes, It appears in a gene for the precursor to epidermal growth factor, and it appears in the gene for factor 9, a blood clotting protein. And very recently, the gene structure has been worked out for those three proteins, and there is, in fact, a single exon that occurs once in factor 9 and three times in the LDL receptor and the epidermal growth factor precursor. And this is now a clear example of what we call exon shuffling, the use of the same exon in totally unrelated proteins. Well, all of these together do suggest that the basic idea that I've suggested to you is correct, at least for the proteins of the late products of differentiation, that those proteins very much have been put together by recombination in introns. But then the problem arises, how is that true in general? Is it only true for the late products of differentiation, or might it be true more generally? And Ford Doolittle was the first to suggest that maybe it was true more generally, because if you can speed up evolution by putting together pieces of genes by recombination, maybe in fact you speeded up evolution all through its history by putting together pieces of genes by recombination. If that is so, then the organisms which don't have introns, the bacteria and the yeasts, organisms like that, must have lost the introns. And that then provides the problem or the paradox that I want to talk to you about for the rest of this lecture. Because on one side, we can imagine a picture in which we have put together genes by recombination at the beginning of evolution. And those organisms that have multiplied most rapidly have lost that. The alternative is that some process took the genes that existed in the bacteria and in primitive cells, assuming those genes to be continuous sequences, and broke those sequences up by inserting introns into them, as though the introns are transposable elements. If that had happened at some point in evolutionary history, after that happened, then the evidence that I've talked to you about shows that after that happened, the introns were used by recombination to shuffle the pieces of genes. But the problem then is, can we decide between those two models? Can we decide if the introns were added to pre-existing genes or the introns were used from the very beginning? In my laboratory, we've tried to attack that problem by looking not at a gene like collagen or a gene like the immunoglobulin genes, which are the very late products of evolution, but looking at genes that are the very early products, very ancient genes. Next slide, please. We've looked at the genes for two enzymes of the glycolytic pathways, triosphosphate isomerase and pyruvate kinase. These are basic biochemical enzymes, enzymes of basic biochemistry, that are involved in the metabolism of carbon atoms as we break down basic sugars to make simpler compounds, or as we build up three carbon structures to make the six carbon structures that are the basic sugars. So that we would expect these enzymes to be present as early as we had any biochemistry at all. And in fact, we know that the structure of this protein is the same in vertebrates and in yeast. And we know from the identity of the sequence that the three-dimensional structure, in fact, must be the same in bacteria and, in fact, in all species. The same is true for pyruvate kinase. These enzymes, so these proteins represent very ancient proteins, which are identical in all species of life. Secondly, we chose them because they have very pronounced three-dimensional structures, which are shown in these cartoons. The subunit of triosphosphate isomerase is an eight-fold, what is called beta-alpha barrel. Protein chain begins here and then comes up here in a beta sheet. Then the protein chain continues and goes to an alpha helix, back down again, up through another beta sheet, back down to an alpha helix, up through a beta sheet, back through an alpha helix, and so on around this structure. And then these beta sheets of amino acids interact with each other to form this central core. And two of these subunits go together to make the final enzyme. Pyruvate kinase is a much larger protein, but part of the protein has exactly the same structure as trisphosphodiesterase. It's again an eightfold barrel, which a protein chain begins over here, comes up and goes down through this looped structure. But at this point, which is where this loop is in trisphosphodiesterase, at this point the protein chain goes off and there's a whole domain of material added on. And then the protein chain comes back and continues through this structure until it comes here to the carboxy terminal end, at which point again there's another domain in pyruvate kinase. The question that we wanted to ask was, first, are these structures broken up? If we look at these genes in the vertebrates, are they broken up at all by introns, or are the genes in vertebrates the same sort of continuous structures that they are in bacteria? If they are broken up by introns, then is there any connection between the way in which the introns lie in these structures and these three-dimensional structures? For example, this structure might be broken in half to produce two structures, each with four in it. It might be broken up into quarters, or it might be broken up into eighths, reflecting this symmetry. For pyruvate kinase, that structure does look very much like the trisphosphodiesterase structure, with an added domain here and an added domain there. Well, nothing is easier to imagine if there is an intron-exon structure for this protein than that this extra domain is on separate exons that were added into this structure, and therefore we'd expect to find an intron here. And this last domain at the very end that's attached here, we would expect to find an intron at that position, dividing the body of the protein from that last domain. So we have certain expectations if these genes turned out to have introns. And in my laboratory, Donald Strauss worked out the structure of the trisphosphodiesterase gene from chickens, and Niels Lomberg worked out the structure of pyruvate kinase, also from chickens. Next slide. And this is the exon structure for chicken trisphosphodiesterase. Well, the first question is then answered. The gene has seven exons. It has six introns. It's broken up very much in the vertebrates. Secondly, the way in which the introns fall a gene is not terribly random, because all the exons are almost all the same length. And had the introns just been added randomly into the gene, we'd expect the length of the exons, in fact, to be some very short ones, some very long ones. We expect that length to be very random, whereas in fact most of them are about 30 long. And you see they're really quite closely clustered. They do break up the gene mostly in the pieces that have a beta sheet, with one exception. There's one exon that has two beta sheets. So the gene is not perfectly broken up into the eightfold pieces. But it is broken up at the sort of borders of elements of the secondary structure. Next slide. And this is a cartoon like the one I showed you before, but now colored to show how the introns lie. And there is an intron here that breaks the gene up into halves. There's an intron over here that breaks up the gene into a three-quarter point, but there's no corresponding intron this side. There is an intron right here that breaks this loop of the protein up. Next slide. This dissects that last picture to show you that the protein is in fact put together out of these little loops of structure, if we view it as assembled out of this set of exons. Let's look at pyruvate kinase. On the next slide, please. Again, pyruvate kinase is broken up in the chicken into 10 exons. And again, the exons are of a roughly coherent size, this time around 50 amino acids long. This time the structure is a little more pronounced. The structure on each of the exons is an alpha helix followed by a beta sheet, an alpha helix followed by a beta sheet. alpha helix followed by a beta sheet, two structures like that, two structures like that, again, sort of two structures like that. So there's much more suggestion here that simple structures have been used, put together to assemble this protein. In the next slide, we'll show you the way these structures fit together in space. Here is another drawing of pyruvate kinase, and this is that eightfold beta barrel, and the sequence comes out that loop domain up on top, goes back into this barrel, comes out into these domains, this domain at the bottom. And this is the way the protein is broken up into little pieces of that barrel, three somewhat similar pieces. And we come out, we go through this domain out on top. We do have an intron right here between the barrel and this domain up on top. As we come out of the domain, the B domain, we do not have an intron in this loop. We come back into the beta barrel here and there and there. At the very end of the barrel here, there is an intron that breaks the protein and separates this body of the protein from this added domain on the bottom, which is then broken in turn into three pieces. So we see in this structure some of the features we expected. We see the introns separating these domains. We see one intron separating this domain. We don't see all the features we hoped for. Well, we've answered two of the questions. One question completely. The old gene, when seen in the vertebrates, has a lot of introns. Second question was, do those introns define, let us say, pieces, subdomains of the protein in some coherent sense? And there the suggestion is very much that they do, because of the regularity of the pieces that the protein are assembled out of. Are there other possible interpretations? Could those introns have been added to some pre-existing gene in a way which produced a pattern like this? There's been one idea of how that might happen. If you added the intron to a pre-existing gene, but the introns added with the time that you added them were very mutagenic, then they would change the gene structure, and you could not add them into any part of the gene which you required. You could add them only in a part of the gene which you didn't require. And that would produce a pattern somewhat like this, in which the introns, it might produce a pattern like this, in which the introns were in pieces of the protein, like this loop, or right here, a place which you did not require. Next slide analyzes that problem more carefully for these two proteins. Because we can ask, do the introns lie in the places in which the protein sequence is inessential, or do they lie where the protein sequence is essential? By plotting here the degree to which the sequence is conserved, if we compare the gene in chicken and the gene in yeast. And that plot is here for both trans phosphate isomerase and pyruvate kinase. These points are the points at which the protein sequence is very well conserved, or identical, between yeast and chicken. And in fact, 40% of the amino acid sequence is actually identical between those two. These are the points at which a protein sequence is most different. The model I suggested for you would say that the introns should occur at these dips in the protein structure, as this one does, or this one. But you see, if you look here, that while some of the introns seem to occur close to the dips, it's not true for all of them. It's not a universal rule that the introns occur where the protein structure is not conserved. The introns occur here. These introns occur in positions in which the protein structure is fully conserved. And in fact, if you ask that question another way around, if you ask, let's say, for trans-phosphate-isomerase, how much of the protein structure is fully conserved, and are there any introns that occur where the protein structure is identically conserved in all organisms, then you discover that two of the introns occur where the protein structure is fully conserved. And that's really the statistical expectation, as though the introns have been put in by some rule that has nothing to do with the conservation of protein structure. Next slide. There has been one theoretical idea that provides some, at this moment, some interpretation of why the exons are what they are. And that's an idea that was suggested by Mitiku Go, a Japanese crystallographer. What she did was to construct a distance plot, in this case for globin, hemoglobin. And what is plotted here is the position of each amino acid here and there, and on this triangular map, some indication of the distance between those two residues in space. The black areas represent pairs of amino acids, for example, amino acid 40 and amino acid 10, which are very far apart, more than 28 angstroms apart. The gray areas represent pairs of amino acids that are 7 angstroms apart. That's the closest they can be along the peptide chain. And the white areas are everything intermediate. And you see that if you make that plot, there is this very pronounced pattern in it. And if you indicate on that plot the position of the two introns in globin, one here and one there, it breaks that pattern in a very suggestive way. And she looked at that plot and decided, well, if the plot was broken here and broken there, it clearly called for drawing a line here and there, and that would then break the plot up in a completely symmetric fashion, and suggest that maybe there should be an intron at this position. Well, there is not an intron at this position in globin, in myoglobin, in the vertebrates. But in leg hemoglobin, which is a plant gene related, distantly related to these, she didn't know at the time, but the sequence had just been done by Keeld Marker, and that has an intron at this position, an intron here, and an intron a few amino acids over from the position she drew in this chart. So in fact, the underlying thought that's embodied in this chart that is true in the sense that we can find a globin which has all of these introns, and we could say that for hemoglobin or myoglobin, they lost this intron at some part in their history. How can we interpret this chart? One is by this pattern of dark and light areas. But I think, in fact, what the chart, the better interpretation of the chart, is to realize that what is happening here is that we're constructing a series of triangles along this diagonal, which avoid the black areas. And what that means is that this exon represents a set of amino acids in the protein that all lie, with a few exceptions, all lie essentially close to each other, within 28 angstroms of each other. And this exon has that property, and this one, and this. That this breakup of the protein here and there has broken it up into modules, into chunks of protein that are close together in this sense. Whereas had we broken it up into this piece has a large region right here in which these amino acids are 28 angstroms away from those amino acids. So that this, the agreement of this plot suggests that what the exons are coherent units of protein structure in that all the amino acids coded for the exons lie close to each other. Next slide. Now that's in fact true for pyruvate kinase, and this is a similar plot done in a few colors for pyruvate kinase, where the red is the things that are closest together, the white is intermediate, and the light blue is further apart, and dark blue is further apart still. And you see it's again, there's a pattern in this. The pattern I want to focus on is, for example, right here, we see a little triangle created for each of these first three exons. And that's saying that each of these exons is in fact a module in Matiku Go's sense. And that pattern is true here. It's true for this exon, this one, and that. It's not true for this one, in which we would certainly prefer to see an intron at this position to have broken the structure like that. But for 9 out of 10 exons, the pattern does work, and those are modules in Matiku Go's sense. And this particular one is, next slide please, is this one, exon 5, and it is in fact the one which is coming from this domain at the top of the protein and going back into the barrel on the bottom, and that's in fact the one which logically you'd say, if there's any logic in the pattern, should have been broken by an intron at this position. So the agreement with the thought that most of these units, most of these exons, code for small pieces of the protein is pretty good for pyruvate kinase. It is not quite so good for triosphosphatidylsomerase. Half, but about half of the exons clearly follow that pattern, and the others look more like something which should be broken up. Now, what I've shown you so far is evidence that says if we look at the genes in vertebrates, now if we look at very ancient genes, I showed you earlier, if we look at very recent genes, if we look at the genes in the vertebrates, they're all broken up into exons and introns, and they're broken up in a way which would suggest that they might have been put together by assembly, by recombination in the exons. Can we get any better evidence, any other evidence, that this might be the case? Well, the argument that the genes are put together by assembly suggests that the places in which the genes have lost introns, as let's say in the yeast, would be because the yeasts have specialized for rapid replication. And the places where genes have lost introns, like Drosophila, are places in which the insects or the organisms have specialized for rapid replications. So if we look at some other eukaryotes that has not specialized for rapid replication, maybe we'll find the original genes looking like the genes in the vertebrates. And so what we've done is to look at the triosphosphatase gene in plants. And we've gone to maize and isolated the triosphosphatase gene, and Mark Marchione in my laboratory has been sequencing the gene from plants. Go two slides forward, please. We haven't finished. Next slide, please. We haven't finished all of the gene from plants yet, but we've sequenced about two-thirds of it, of two genes, which turn out to be almost identical. And what we see is shown on this slide, in which we've shown here the structure of triosphosphatase, and here the position of the introns from the chicken. We sequenced the second half of the gene from plants, and we found five introns. And of those, three are at identical places, this one, and this one, such identical places to the ones in chicken. This one is not an identical place, but it's three amino acids over. And in fact, we interpret this as the intron having moved by changing its splicing position and even number of codons. A very simple movement, and there are other examples in other genes where that has happened. There's one extra intron in this position in the plant, which is not there in the chicken. It's actually at a bend in the very last alpha helix. And that's at this position in the protein. The alpha helix runs this way. It turns sharply, and the intron occurs right at the bend. And in fact, you'll notice that all of the introns are, in fact, very close, essentially at boundaries of secondary structure units. Well, I regard the agreement between the positions of these introns and these as too high to be what we would expect had we added these introns and these introns totally independently into some pre-existing gene after the separation of the plants, the algae, from the cells that led to the animals. And so I regard this as much more likely that the original gene in the original eukaryotic cell was broken up by introns into an exon pattern that's essentially this one, and that what we see here is the loss, the exact loss of this intron in the line that led to the vertebrates and its preservation in the line that led to the plants. And therefore, from this evidence, I think we can deduce that the gene in the original eukaryotic cell more than a billion years ago was broken up into exons and introns, and that one line, the line that picked up the chloroplast and led to the plants, preserved that structure, and the line that did not pick up the chloroplast but led to the animals preserved that structure, and the structure was lost from cells like the yeasts and from cells like the Drosophila, it was lost in cells that have specialized to grow very rapidly, and therefore, in fact, have evolved through very many more generations than the cells in the plants and in the vertebrates that have not specialized for rapid growth, but have, in fact, specialized for development of complex organisms. I regard it as most likely, then, but unproven, unfortunately, by this evidence, that the first gene in the cell that became a eukaryotic cell, that was like the other cells around it but picked up by symbiosis, mitochondria or chloroplasts, other organelles, that if those genes were broken up, then in fact all of the genes that existed at that time in evolutionary history were essentially broken up, that these genes for the glycolytic pathway were broken up when they were first assembled in the cells from which the prokaryotes and eukaryotes ultimately derived. That they were assembled out of exons which represented little pieces of protein structure. These ideas ultimately, I think, not only give us a picture of evolution as starting in a slightly different position than we thought it did, it gives us a picture of the proteins as assembled not as horrendously complicated structures, but actually assembled by some set of rules from some underlying simpler set of structures. And that actually, as a thought, which is the thought I'll leave you with, is a thought that's very encouraging in terms of our ability to ultimately understand the way the proteins are finally put together and the way they fold. Thank you.